You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 23rd of September 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show, as Volkswagen's woes spread and CEO resigns, I'll look at what lies ahead for the embattled automaker with my studio guests, Quentin Peel and Kathleen Burke. And it wasn't enough to save former White House hopeful Scott Walker after he was sent packing back to Wisconsin. So just how much power do super PACs wield in the American presidential race? Plus, how do you determine a reasonable price for life-saving drugs?
At the end of the day, the price per course of treatment to save your life was only $1,000. And we know these days in modern pharmaceuticals, cancer drugs can cost $100,000 or more. Rare disease drugs can cost $500,000. Mm-hmm. Daraprim is still underpriced relative to its peers.
That CEO has quickly become one of the world's most hated men after he raised the price of an AIDS drug by about 5,000%. Is the company acting unethically, or is regulation at fault for its impotence in stopping him? And later in the show, another unexpected turn in the New Zealand flag debate as a wild card entrant emerges. And this one seems to carry the support of the public. But is it any good? We'll have all the answers coming up on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. Well, we've made some big promises there. We're going to have all the answers in the next 30 minutes to a big range of topics. Welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Quentin Peel, who's the Associate Fellow at Chatham House and also a contributor for the Financial Times, and Kathleen Burke, who's Professor of Modern and Contemporary History at University College here in London. Welcome both to the programme. First up, we're going to look at the scandal embroiling Volkswagen, which today claimed the scalp of the company's CEO, Martin Winterkorn. There's no shortage of headlines devoted to the German carmaker at the moment after it emerged the company had rigged emission tests for US regulators. The damage to the share price is setting in, not to mention the hit to the company's reputation. And the launch of the international probes into the company's activities in other regions may prove to be just the beginning of a rather big story. Quentin, the resignation, it means more than somebody being toppled from the top of a company. This could be long-term serious damage to this company's reputation. We've seen in the past where car makers have made small errors. It can take 10, 20 years for them to correct their reputation. How bad do you think this is for German car makers, brand Germany? Tell us how big a hit you think it is.
Well, I think it really is very serious. I mean, here's a company that didn't just make a mistake. It absolutely deliberately tried to fiddle these tests. And they've admitted it, at least that straight up front. Here is a company that probably almost more than any other company, with possibly the exception of Daimler-Benz, represents everything that's sort of good and wonderful about German engineering, wonderful cars, and now, the largest car manufacturer in the world. So I think it's very bad for brand Germany as well as for the whole motor car industry. I'm not entirely sure this is going to be limited to Volkswagen. I have a nasty feeling that we're going to see a knock-on effect through other motor manufacturers, and it's going to be very bad for the European motor industry, because that's the one sector of the motor industry that produces a hell of a lot of diesel engine cars, and that's where the problem lies.
Kathleen, what's your take on this? Because it strikes me that, here we have a car maker, as we said, that seems to represent everything that's good about Germany, and there's so many European industries that have taken a hit in the US, whether it's banking, it's been the LIBOR scandals, there's been trading scandals, whether you look at the oil industry, BP's reputation in America. It feels like a lot of European companies are not doing very well at protecting their interests by behaving rather badly when they go to the US.
Well, there's various things there, aren't there? First of all, one thing that's really striking to me about the whole Volkswagen thing is, because this had to be installed in all these cars, what happened to a whistleblower? I mean, one would have thought someone somewhere would have pointed out this was happening. Certainly, in any number of American situations, this would have happened. Europeans forget how litigious the United States is. Leaping into a class action court, court fight with alacrity. And regulation is actively pursued in the United States. It does sometimes seem to me that regulation is a default position almost in Europe. You just don't hear about it very much.
But also, I guess here in Europe, we get used to people getting a slapped wrist for doing things wrong in the corporate sphere. But in the US, you go to jail.
You don't get slapped in the States. You get slapped with a $7 billion fine. And then if you're unlucky, you go to jail. I would quite like, I think if Winkelhorn had been slapped with his own very own individual fine, things might have been changed. I mean, a real problem is not going after the decision makers in this. What I am glad to see, since he obviously knew it was happening, he didn't say he didn't know it was happening, he had to go. What's really surprising, it took so many hours for the board to make him the scapegoat and kick him out.
Kathleen points to something interesting here, because this has been going on not just for a few months. This has apparently been going on like since 2009, for a long period of years. And as Kathleen says, there must have been a culture there that, you know, if you imagine that had been in place for some time, there must have been quite a few people who knew that there was some wrongdoing going on there, which points to something really wrong within the culture of the whole company. So it's great always that you get rid of the CEO, but it stems from more than one person, doesn't it?
It's a huge company, but it's a highly centralized company with a very sort of, the CEO is incredibly powerful. It's also not the first time that Volkswagen has got into this sort of mess. Do you remember, it's more than 10 years ago now, but they got into this mess where they were discovered to have been effectively bribing the trade unionists on their company board by setting up parties with prostitutes and everything else. And that was a great scandal and caused another head to roll. This is an enormous company, and I think there is a lack of internal whistleblowing, if you like, for people to actually say, hey, this just doesn't work. And of course, we're not talking about a big black box that was put into these cars. This is a tiny bit of software. Somebody's very clever produced this software that recognized when there were tests happening and immediately reduced the emissions or the nasty stuff that was coming out of the exhaust pipe.
And what's going to be interesting there, the hints are that it's not the only company that had that.
Yeah,
and so this may well spread.
Don't you think there's an element here that says it's actually technology, yet again, getting ahead of good sense? It's a bit like the global financial crisis, where the capacity of playing with amazing derivatives and so on just overwhelmed the fundamental good sense that should have been there. We shouldn't get exposed to this stuff. Somebody came along with a technological solution, said, you can get round these tests, and nobody was there sensible enough to say, don't do it.
Whatever happened to ethics, do you suppose?
that's a county in the south of England, I believe. But the other thing to say about that is, you know, what's interesting is for Germany, here they are going around the world saying, you can clean up your nations, you can sort out what you do by following German technology. We've got the technology to change, you know, the environment with the greenest country sitting in Europe. Look at us, we're amazing. And now you must think, hold on, I'm sitting in China being sold all this German technology, and it kind of doesn't work. Oh, is this reliable in any of these spheres? If I look at, you know, wind power, if I look at any of these things, are they fiddling the tests? Because I think that's the knock-on. It's not going to just affect Volkswagen. It's going to affect every single German business is now tainted by this.
Well, I'm not sure, because I think you'll find that an awful lot of what Germany produces simply does the job better than anybody else's stuff.
Well, that's what we thought about Volkswagen.
Yeah, but this, what you're talking about in Germany, the fundamental strength of Germany is the machine tools. It's the machines that make machines. Now, it is undoubtedly going to cause massive heart searching in Germany, because it hits at the two, if you like, biggest sort of profits of the German economy. One is environmentalism, and the second is the motor industry. But they've always been in potential conflict. Remember that Germany is the one country that refuses to have a speed limit on its roads, because it loves to have fast cars. But when they drive fast, they produce far more emissions.
We're going to come back to this in a minute. But the other funny thing, Kathleen, I was going to say is, when I was in a conference last week, I met with a guy called Martin Munter, who works for Stuttgart City Council. He was saying, OK, we can cope with the arrival of so many migrants. And this is the odd little link, because we have all these big industries like car manufacturing, which can absorb these people. They need people. It looks likely the Volkswagen will be laying people off, just as Germany needs to kind of really build up its economy. If its sales slump, these are the kinds of things, you know, oddly, it's a bit of a joined up world for Germany at the moment.
Could I just point out, possibly I shouldn't say, but we historians cannot help but remember that Volkswagen was started by the Nazis. Purely, well, for all sorts of reasons, but it's the origins of its culture are concentrated, I think one might say, and hierarchical. And I get the impression from what Quentin was saying that that's part of, could be part of the difficulty.
Well, I think that's I think obviously it has a tough piece of history. I'm not sure I could argue that it runs all the way through to today. But that's the story of what's happening at Volkswagen. We could stay in the carport, but I think we need to move on. The Republicans and super PACs is the focus of our next story, because if anyone needed proof that in America's race to the White House, early poll results mean very little, they needn't look any further than Scott Walker. The Wisconsin governor jumped into the contest in July amid a pool of wealthy donors and encouraging results in Iowa. But as the Trump machine continues to warp proceedings into a frightening imitation of a reality TV show, Scott Walker is stepping aside and calling on others to follow suit. But falling popularity isn't the only issue at play here. Walker's funding has also taken a battering. Now, we must start with you, Kathleen. I never really quite understand the machinations. It's so complex how this money is raised, the power of the super PACs, how this money sits apart. Because campaign funds and super PACs are meant to be two different things, but it's all getting a bit meshed up, isn't it?
Well, the point of super PACs is that the money can't go to pay the individual bills of candidates. It can't pay for their rooms. It can't pay for their computers and so forth and so on. They have to raise the money elsewhere, regular donations, one might say, from real people, from merely wealthy people rather than companies. Super PAC money, PAC is Political Action Committee, and these super PACs, their money goes for television adverts and that sort of thing that are frightfully expensive. But the point of Walker is that he had all this super PAC money, but he couldn't pay any bills because, A, he'd been spending so much time, as did others, raising the super PAC money and therefore not building up links with individual donors, with merely wealthy people, as they say. So therefore, when push came to shove, the money was there in the bank, but he couldn't touch it.
So just distill it for me. So he had super PAC money that would allow him to get these adverts and things, but he couldn't pay
He couldn't pay for the bus.
Okay. When we look at the tale of super PACs, so first of all, he's now asked for other people to follow suit and step down. It's a huge field. I think it's 15 people still left. Do you think other people will follow suit? And do you think, more importantly, he's quite determined, that it's time to change the narrative, that we need to push Mr. Trump out of the way. But that seems a little bit far off, don't you think?
Well, you've got this very weird situation where the top three runners in this race are precisely the ones who've never been politicians. You've got Donald Trump, you've now got Carly Fiorina, and you've got
Ben Carson
coming in third.
Thanks.
All the politicians are lower down, and there's Jeb Bush, who's not budging on about 9% support. He was the one who was expected to come romping through. So you've got a real problem that everybody seems to be wanting non-politicians. And the fact that they've got a really peculiar non-politician in Donald Trump dominating the scene. So what Scott Walker's trying to do is to say, let's at least unite behind a real politician who can defeat him. At the moment, that's not happening. I mean, Donald Trump is down a bit. I think he's on about 24% support, and Carly's on about 15% support. And as I said, Jeb Bush is down at 9%. But we are still quite a long way from the end game here. There is a danger, though. Donald Trump can finance himself all the way through. And so that puts huge pressure on the other ones to try and build up a real war chest.
Kathleen, can Trump be trumped?
Oh, please, God. It's a real problem. You've got three top candidates, one of whom is a bombastic, not particularly always truthful billionaire, One is a very impressive lady, but who had to leave her company because it was in such dire straits, which some have blamed her. And then an extremely nice neurosurgeon with a wonderful narrative history, certainly rags to riches, but some very strange ideas. And
such as that you can't be a Muslim in there and be a U.S. president.
That's what the Constitution says, he says. Whereas the Constitution says there should be no, will not abridge any right to religious freedom. I mean, what is really worrying is the disaffection of the American population that if a person is a Washington politician, you pull your skirts away so you don't brush his leg. It is the political system, the whole political culture in the United States, as far as national politics are concerned, should be a worry for everyone. It does seem to me that everyone in the world should be able to vote for the American president because we are all touched by the decisions. And I think non-Americans should be as worried as Americans at the dysfunctionality we're seeing in front of us.
But I think, do you think, Quentin, it's a bit of a global, a Western moment? Because here in the UK, for example, we had Jeremy Corbyn has won the leadership of the Labour Party. Yes, a politician, but certainly not what you'd imagine a politician to be coming through, or Nigel Farage on the right, or Boris Johnson. In each country, we seem to be falling in with these kind of slightly wackier characters because politics seems to be a bit out of touch with people.
It's clobber the political establishment, if you like, and I think we're seeing it not just in Britain and America, we're seeing it in France, we're seeing it in Germany, we're seeing it all over Europe with the rise of the populist right and the populist left. So it really is a dangerous moment for traditional parliamentary democracy, I think. We're seeing the fragmentation. We're going to have endless coalition governments which are clumsy and don't take decisions quickly, and that will compound, perhaps, the problem of people saying, we don't trust the government.
Well, we're going to move on to another story that's out of the US. There are very few things in life that don't go up in price from time to time, but a 5,000% jump would likely take anyone by surprise. So when the CEO of an American pharmaceutical company started boasting about hiking the price of an AIDS drug from about $13 a pill to $750 a pill, the outrage was swift and fierce. Martin Shkreli has very few friends at the moment, but he's acted within the law. But do we all expect companies to act both ethically and morally too? Or is that trust rather misplaced? Catherine, this is a gentleman, he has a financial background. He made a lot of money. He bought a company. He saw an opportunity to raise the price of this drug. His argument, as we heard at the top of the show, is, actually, when you compare it to other drugs on the market, this is still cheap, but you're still being able to save your life for a very cheap price, he says. You could be, if you have some very rare disease in the US, you could be charged $500,000 a year on your insurance for your drugs. Do you think he is just following the capitalist model, or do you think there was something a bit more wicked in what happened here?
Well, he seems not the sort of person you'd want to dine with very often or turn your back to, I must say. His whole career in finance has been of acting unethically, shall we say, and occasionally unlawfully. He seems to have no moral compass. He's only 32. It was quoted, someone did quote saying his
I don't think 32 is any excuse to be kind of a bad person, though, is it?
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't realize of course, you're still in the
25. No, I wish. Gosh, I bid farewell to 32 quite a long time ago, but I still remember it, though.
What I mean is he's had a jam-packed business life, shall we say. This what's more surprising about this, other than trying to do it, because he's not the first drug company that's done. There's lists one can, if we had 15 minutes, I'm sure Quentin and I could list a lot of them. But that he's so blazoned about it. Normally, you at least pretend to be sorry or to whatever. And what he said was bugger off. Nothing to do with you. Everyone does it. It's really cheap at the price. And what's $750 day by day by day by day?
It's extraordinary because the truth is he's not a drug manufacturer. This guy is a financial wheeler dealer. He's a complete chancer and he's totally amoral. He doesn't care where he makes his money. Up to now, most of his bids have been in shorting pharmaceutical companies. That's to say, assuming that they're going to fail in getting a new drug on the market. Now, the reason why drug prices are very high at a certain end of the market is, and has always been argued by the drug companies, that it's the cost of development. They have to get a high price to begin with, otherwise nobody will ever develop drugs. But this is precisely what Mr. Shkreli is not doing. He's taken a 62-year-old drug way out. It's paid off all its development costs decades ago. But he's discovered a little niche in the market that if you can highly restrict its distribution, nobody else is going to be able to copy it very quickly. And he can get away with this. I think he's going to fail. I think it's actually going to blow up in his face. But the danger behind it is, I think the pharmaceutical companies themselves have got to realise that by having very high-priced drugs, they're attracting people like Mr. Shkreli to come into the market and rig it.
I think that's true. I think that the notion of big pharma, it's become, people are kind of had enough of what they see as its kind of attempts to, take the top dollar for every drug that it produces. So it's kind of left the field a little bit open to him, do you think, Catherine? He thinks he's just doing what everyone else is doing.
Yes, in that sense, I think that's entirely wrong. I think he saw a way of doing it and that he was going to do it before others actually discovered it. What he will also possibly have done is to bring on the heads of most big pharma possible regulatory decisions. I mean, Hillary Clinton has now said that if she becomes president, she's going to take them on, essentially. So he may well find that he won't care, of course, but there are an awful lot of well-paid people who will.
Well, I said we'd have all the answers in 30 minutes, but I think we're doing pretty well so far. But we're going to take a short break now where we get the rest of our answers ready. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck, Quentin Peel and Kathleen Burke. Coming up, though, the EU discusses the refugee crisis yet again, and Slovakia isn't very happy. Plus, we'll cast our eyes over a wild card entrant in New Zealand's search for a brand new flag.
Do you work in magazines, or do you call yourself a mag aficionado, or are you a regular listener to The Stack, Monocle 24's weekly magazine industry review and analysis show? If it's the latter, you're in for a treat, because this week, as we celebrate the launch of Monocle's new retail concept Kiosk Cafe, by taking the mag industry bull by the horns and inviting you to take part. This Saturday, the 26th of September at 10 a.m. London time, The Stack will be hosting a live discussion featuring some very special panel guests hosted by me, Tyler Brulé, in front of a live studio audience. Present at our live editorial meeting will be Olivier Royan, the editor of Périmatch, Gert Jonkers, editor of Fantastic Man, Ian Birch, consultant on media strategy transformation and magazine hack, and last but by no means least, Eric Speakerman, typographer, designer and information architect. From pitching the right editorial line to starting a new independent magazine to managing a successful redesign, our agenda will be action-packed. So make sure you tune in, or for the very first time, come in person by going to the Stack Live event page at monocle.com. But be quick, as there are only a few tickets remaining. Don't say you didn't get the memo.
Now, welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me, of course, are Quentin Peel and Kathleen Burke. Now, leaders across the EU are again behind closed doors in Brussels today for more discussions on how to deal with Europe's refugee crisis. Meanwhile, things took a heated tone in Serbia today after the country delivered an ultimatum to Croatia to either reopen its borders to cargo traffic or face unspecified consequences. Yesterday's vote to redistribute some 120,000 refugees has faced strong criticism among some nations due to it being determined by a majority rather than a consensus vote. Do they have a point? Quentin, do they?
Well, it's a real dividing line between Eastern Europe and Western Europe, if you like, here. And I think it is going to be very difficult to bridge this gap. There's the feeling, I think, has taken root finally in Western Europe that something must be done to help these poor refugees flooding in. And the East Europeans are simply saying, yeah, but not by us. We're not the ones who can afford to do this. We're not used to this. And the dividing line is very real. I mean, okay, the countries that actually voted against this, Hungary, the Czech Republic, Romania, and who was Slovakia was the last one. Poland, interestingly, joined the majority. But I was in Estonia last week, and these are really good guys in Estonia, but they're very uncomfortable at the idea of being told you've got to take a quota of refugees. So there we are. The division is there. But what the Hungarians have been doing, for example, blocking their border is literally dumping all these refugees on poor old Serbia next door, who are even poorer than they are and have got less facilities to do anything. The only possible solution has got to be a pan-European solution. And in that point, I would certainly say the one country that is not pulling its weight by a long way is the United Kingdom, because they are refusing to take part in any pan-European solution. They're talking of taking a few more refugees, but nothing like the level that they would be taking compared to other countries in Europe.
So, Catherine, let's start unpicking this, because there's a couple of interesting points here. First of all, the Hungarians have said, look, the whole thing is a nonsense. Fine, we'll take 10,000 people or 1,000 people, but once they've got a passport, they're just going to move anywhere in Europe. So in the end, they will all go to Germany anyway. So that's where they want to go. We can keep them here for 1 year, 2 years, 3 years. But in the end, the very nature of having a passport that you can use in the Schengen area is you can go wherever you like.
Yes. Hungary is a very special case, is it not? Because it has traditionally been extremely protective of its borders. After all, in the early years, they had to keep the Huns out, Attila the Hun and so forth, and trying to keep itself apart from Austria when it was in an empire. So Hungary has always been pretty conservative, and the current government is even more conservative, and the current government is a very controlling government. And I think fundamentally, they just don't want to lose control. And which is not surprising if you think about it.
But if you think about their history and the fact that there were 200,000 Hungarian refugees who were welcomed into other countries after 1956, they seem to be a bit sort of deaf to their history.
Of course, there's an irony there. So Viktor Orban, who's definitely come out as the baddie in this story in most people's. But one of his points, which I think is debatable, he says, look, immigration has to be controlled because, we feel we're a European country and we don't want to become a country with a large Muslim minority. Now, I understand that, we live in London where that has been the case for a long time and it's worked very successfully. But actually, if you go to Japan, they don't have a large Muslim majority because they don't give a passport to anybody. If you go to lots of countries, if you go to a Muslim country, they don't have a lot. If you go to Saudi Arabia, they don't give passports to Christian people. They won't even let you go into many of the cities if you're a Christian. So lots of countries around the world have taken a stance and said, actually, we like being majority Muslim or we like being majority Jewish. Is he allowed to have that opinion? Is he allowed to say, actually, because this is what Slovakia said, it said, okay, we'll take migrants from Syria, but we'll just take the Christian ones. Is that an unfair opinion to have?
Yes, I think absolutely. I think it's a completely unacceptable opinion to have about refugees. A refugee's status should be blind to their religion and their race. These are desperate people. Now, the fact that there is a minority of this number who may be economic migrants, something like that, okay, they need to be given decent conditions and swift adjudication of whether they are genuine asylum, deserve asylum or not. But the illogic of the Hungarian position is stop them coming in when precisely what you said earlier, they will be able to move on to the country that they want to go to afterwards. So why not just help them go through?
Now, look, we've got about a minute left, but we have to do the topic which I've been covering, I think, on every single show for the last few months. I've been following the New Zealand flag story. Here's the story in short. New Zealand has a flag. It thinks it's a bit colonial. Should it get rid of it? Maybe, maybe not. Has a competition. Loads of people pile in with designs. It gets a load of designs that unfortunately look a bit like ISIS. Popular vote. People have crowdsourced another one called Red Peak. May look like something you see on the side of a Nazi hut. But anyway, you've seen the design. Kathleen Burke, would you change your national flag for Red Peak? It sounds like a coffee brand, doesn't it, Red Peak? But would you change it for Red Peak?
Well, no, but then I wouldn't have a fern either, which is what seems to be dominating most of the others.
Quentin, you have about 10 seconds to give us your design view of the world.
I do not like flags. I think if you've got to have one, hang on to the one you've got. The trouble is, it's got the Union Jack on it.
Well, I'm sad to say we're going to have to leave it there. Quentin Peel and Kathleen Burke, thank you very much for joining us today on Midori House. Today's show was produced by Ben Rylan. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and also by Federica Rominello. And our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. For the next hour, Chris Lord is going to be bringing you lots of nice music. But from me, Andrew Tuck, it's just time to say thank you for listening and goodbye.